Hey friends, we have a new sponsor today, and I want to make sure that you support them because they make Hansel Minutes possible. RavenDB. It's a document database that's non-relational and fully transactional. It's available for Windows and Linux with official client APIs for .NET, the JVM, Go, Ruby, Node.js, and Python. RavenDB is designed for high performance, handling tens of thousands of requests, even on a single node. Now, RavenDB is capable of on-the-fly optimization, dynamic indexes, and much more. It has a fully loaded GUI, which means it's simpler to operate, and you don't need, you know, arcane incantations on the command line. It just works. It's fast, and it's right. Download your free community edition at ravendb.net. That's RavenDB.net. I hope you check it out. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Dr. Nicole Forsgren. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am lovely, and I'm here reading your report. You've just released a report called Accelerate, the State of DevOps Strategies for a New Economy. And you know, the first thing that I see when I scroll down and I look at the bottom, there's a series of sponsors. I usually assume that a DevOps or any kind of a research document like this would be sponsored by someone that's trying to sell me their thing. But I see Amazon and I see Azure and I see Google Cloud and a bunch of other cloud people. That seems like a big deal.
I know, right? So the interesting thing and the really unique thing about this report is that it's not a vendor report, right? This is not just a typical vendor report. This is rigorous research. It's like rigorous academic level research. I used to be a professor. I have a PhD. Mm-hmm. And it's vendor and tool agnostic. You'll actually notice several competitors on this report. Like you note, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud is our collaborator and our diamond sponsor. Mm-hmm. And so as you kind of scroll through the report, as you probably also noticed, it talks about capabilities. It talks about practices. It talks about strategies to drive high performance. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ever talk about a particular tool. It doesn't talk about particular things, except a couple places where we might list like an example, right? It talks about ways to get better. It's never trying to sell you anything.
Mm. When someone looks at a report like this, I think that we as the audience, we as the people who are listening, don't really have a way to judge whether a report is good or not. We might look at it and say, well, this is well designed or this looks pretty, or, but sometimes these reports can be disguised, like you say, as a vendor could create it to try to sell me something. But there is a non-trivial amount of research behind this. This isn't opinion that we're looking at, correct?
Right. This is pretty solid. So what we actually do, this is a 5 or 6 month process. And again, right, as I mentioned, this is academic research. So the team behind this is myself, Jez Humble, Gene Kim, and we actually roll this into academic research. This is published in peer review. And we have also rolled this. This is year 5 for us, the core team. The mm-hmm. first 4 years of research have also been published in the book Accelerate, in addition to all of the academic research that we've also published. So,
right. And Accelerate, we're going to have a link to this, the science behind DevOps with, as you said yourself, Jez Humble and Gene Kim, published by IT Revolution out of Portland, Oregon, where I am.
Yeah. So, and I guess to answer, you know, the second half of what you're saying, you're right. It can be really difficult to kind of figure out if someone's trying to sell you something or if it's real research. We do our best to be really clear about what it is that we're asking, what it is that we're doing. We have a method section at the back of every research report that we've put out. In the book, part 2 is all research, right? Which is funny because some people say, oh, I didn't care about the research. I just wanted to know what to do. And some people say, oh, the findings are nice, but I've read the reports. I really, really loved part 2 because it told me exactly what to do for survey methods or what to do for system measures or what methods you were using. This morning, I got a DM in Twitter from someone saying, what clustering analysis method did you use and why did you select that one? And I need to know how to dig into this. So we really do follow, you know, really rigorous methods that are not only rigorous, but methodologically appropriate for the questions that we're asking.
Mm-hmm. So not to put too fine a point on it, this is not someone put out a Survey Monkey and then went into Excel and made some charts. I'm looking at the end here, and there is an actual whole section of the report that talks about your statistical analysis methods, structural equation modeling, and extensive footnotes on the research and the validation guidelines.
Right. And I love that you point that out, right? Structured equation modeling. We're also very, very careful to make explicit distinctions between what things are summarization, right? Descriptive analysis. So we mm-hmm. have things about demographics and firmographics, what percentage of the industry responded where. We are very careful to point out which things are correlations, which things are predictions, because we do take this a step beyond just correlation. Which things can you do that have been statistically shown to drive performance improvements across different areas of your business? Oh, and by, can I like skip to a spoiler? This is so my favorite thing. Can I just like dig into it? Because this is what, so everyone's like, oh, but this isn't going to work for me, right?
Right.
Our analysis for the last couple of years, and in particular this year, I went ahead and just dove into it even harder this year. We found statistically, industry doesn't matter, right? In a predictive way, there is no statistical evidence to say that industry matters. So if anyone out there is saying, or their management is saying, oh, well, this won't work for us. These practices or principles, whether you want to call them digital transformation or DevOps or Agile, you know, it won't work for us because I work in highly regulated fields. You know, I work in finance, I work in telecom, I work in healthcare. Mm. This won't work for us because we are highly regulated. No, you know what? I have data across, well, first of all, I have over 30,000 data points around the world in dozens of industries. And I've run this analysis and I did the most like rigorous statistical control methods that I could do in our predictive models. Mm-hmm. And there was no statistical evidence that it matters. And I didn't even just group it into highly regulated or non-highly regulated, because then someone could come back and say, oh, but we're more special, right? We're more highly regulated. I tested per industry. I tested technology separately, financial services separately, government separately, healthcare and pharma separately, insurance separately, telecom separately. There's no significance there.
How can we as non-PhDs accept that stuff that is intuitively correct is in fact demonstrably wrong? Like I used to work in banking and I would tell you that my gut says that it's a highly regulated environment and, you know, velocity and those things and matter and these things won't work for us. And my wife works in healthcare. But when you then show the data that says it's not the case, why do we think these things? Why do we feel them in our gut and then find them not true?
Well, so it's really interesting, right? It's so interesting you say that, because so often people will come back and they will say, you know, it's so great to see this data because it helps me confirm what I see and what I know to be true. And then I'll have people come back and they'll say, oh, this is so interesting because it's the opposite of what I see, right? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes people accuse me of just doing confirmation bias. But we see surprises come up in the data, right? Like we really follow the classic scientific method. We generate hypotheses first, mm-hmm. right? Based on industry experience, based on the academic literature, based on a lot of things that we want to test. And then we have like full rigorous research design to figure out what data we need to collect in order to test these hypotheses. And then we go collect the data. And then I go through several steps to kind of test it. And then we do test it. And so we do have this situation where sometimes these biases or presuppositions are confirmed, and sometimes they're totally flipped on their head, right? One of my favorites is the idea that speed and stability are a trade-off. Now, some people have this firmly, firmly held belief that in order to be stable, we have to slow down. Mm-hmm. We have to. But there's another core set of people that at least for a decade now have said, no, I really believe in my heart that if we go faster, we will be more stable. So how do we reconcile these two stories? And how can two groups of people believe something differently? Mm-hmm. How can we have two stories simultaneously? So one story says, I have to slow down to be safe and to be stable. And that story makes sense. right? I can perceive, I can envision a story where slower releases are more safe because I can check it, I can test it, I can reassure myself. Now, there's also another story that we can envision that says, if I go faster, it's safer and it's more stable because going faster means slower release, smaller releases, I mean, right? Smaller bits, smaller risk, right? I'm introducing smaller pieces and smaller risks. So it's actually more sustainable. Mm. But their intention, these are opposite stories. Mm-hmm. What we've found over the last 5 years is that speed and stability move in tandem. The highest performers get both. There is no trade-off.
And you point out here in the report that this is not a surprise this year. This is 5 years in a row that your cluster analysis has shown the relationship between throughput and stability.
Right. And this is something that we let the data drive, right? Mm-hmm. We did have this hypothesis. Well, and early on, right, we're like, I wonder which story is correct.
Right.
I wonder, I genuinely am curious. And it was funny because, you know, Gene and Jez would come in. They're like, I think I know what it is. And I'm like, that's cool. I'm going to let the data tell me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of the data, you point out the data, the spread from the kind of the elite people that have their DevOps experience, their CI, CD kind of really dialed in versus the folks that are the, what we would call the low performers, and no disrespect to them, but we've all worked there. Where, you know, FTPing every few months into production is your deployment strategy. You point out some pretty crazy statistics. I just want to read these really briefly. 46 times more frequent code deployments, 2,555 times faster lead time from commit to deploy. That's a number we got to talk about.
Yeah.
That makes me very uncomfortable. That means that someone might check something in you know, January and not see it in production until March or July. And the elite performers have a much lower change failure rate. They're less likely to fail.
Right. And now when we think about that, though, it's because when you do introduce code, mm-hmm. you're introducing very, very small pieces of code.
Mm.
So that introduction is small. It has a small blast radius.
Mm. Oh, that's
good. It touches much less of your code base. When we think about making a change to code, right? I mean, I was a developer for a little while, right? We all think, oh, I'm going to introduce this piece of code. How like it's not going to break anything. Mm-hmm. Of course, it always breaks something, right? If I introduce a one-line change, how likely is that to break something?
It depends on the line.
It depends on the line. Okay, but if I introduce 100-line or 1,000-line change, how likely is that to break something?
Well, and then that's where you start getting into, like you say, the blast radius. I mean, you throw a pebble into a pool and a ripple.
And how big is the blast? And how big is the change? And how big is your downtime? So the other thing that we discovered this year, so we discovered these elite performers that are very much like the high performers in previous years, right? They're optimizing speed and stability because, oh, I have so many things I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. So I'll start with my high performers and my elite performers.
Okay.
The highest performers really are this group that is optimizing on speed and stability. They're what we called high performers in previous years, right? They're this group that is continuing to push the bar. They're continuing to move forward. They don't make excuses. They're doing well year over year over year. We have this high performance group as well.
Okay.
They're 46% of the market, mm-hmm. of the industry. Mm-hmm. 48%. I love this because it's this incredible signal that high performance is available to everyone. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this huge shift in the industry that this is achievable. It all comes down to execution,
well,
right?
You, Trent, you actually have I'm looking at the report right now on page 20. You are showing the performance metrics over time from 2016, 2017, 2018, and it's accelerating that movement. People are moving from low to high to elite. They're moving forward and becoming better at this. And the time to restore service and incidents, their failure rates, these things are changing. They are failing fast and failing often, and they're getting the sites back up faster.
Right. So the high group is continuing to grow. It's continuing to improve. The mm-hmm. elites are the best, are staying at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. The low performers, though, are starting to fall behind at increasingly larger rates, right? Mm. The change failure rate is getting higher. And we think it's because of increasing complexity in our systems, right? When you do go down, you go down hard. Mm.
Is it the systems or is it the people and their processes?
It could be some of both, right? The processes aren't great. We can't keep up, right? Our practices aren't great. And when you combine those two, that's even harder, right? So we discovered this additional group at the bottom of this low performance group, and we called them misguided performers. And at first I had to convince my team a little bit about why I wanted to name them misguided, because they were like, oh, that's not very nice. And I'm like, yeah, but that's why it's kind of perfect, right? It's like when you make your mom mad, like there's making your mom mad and then there's disappointing your mom, right? Mm-hmm. Like don't disappoint is like the worst thing you can do. So the misguided performers, let me describe them. Again, this is completely data driven.
Okay.
And by the way, I will point out this is 5% of our data. So this is a non-trivial group, right? This is a good solid set. They're deploying between once every 6 months. So their lead time for changes is also between once every 6 months. Mm-hmm. So this is like a reasonable cadence, right? There's going to be a whole bunch of people out there probably in highly regulated fields in government that are like, yeah, that seems good. Their change failure rate is actually better than our lowest performers. When they introduce a change to the system, they only fail between 16 and 30% of the time. So they're like, sweet, we're doing pretty well. Probably because they have instituted strong policies and extra testing, extra quality control, right? Mm-hmm. So like I'm imagining this story, not even imagining. I work with clients, I work with customers, I work with organizations that say, we're going to take a slow and steady approach. We have this cautious approach to releasing software. It's slow, but we have instituted so many guardrails around it. Okay. But when they go down, they are deploying such large, large pieces of software that when they go down hard. Mm-hmm. They're down between 1 and 6 months. And people look at me and they make this face like 1 and 6 months, Nicole, you're crazy. Your analysis is wrong. It's not though, because think about healthcare.gov. Yeah. Think about Sony, right? Like when Sony was hacked 4 times in a row, right? When they had security breaches, customers might be able to access the system between like hours or days later. But how long are we fixing systems on the back end? Right? Mm. We are having to fix systems and infrastructure and restore data for weeks or months. This is a non-trivial problem. So when you spend months getting ready to release software, as we just talked about, you are releasing this huge piece of change into the system that you can no longer understand the implications of.
Yeesh. When you said that the things can go down for that long, I winced because I would just assume that that was an outlier. Like I remember healthcare.gov. I remember Sony. I remember the early days of Xbox Live. But now we as customers are used to outages being a couple of hours. I mean, even I think it was GitLab many, many, many years ago, they deleted a production database. But even that was still measured in, you know, a day or a day and a half. Months seems unconscionable.
But I mean, think of it. There are still websites right now that have planned outages for a whole day on a weekend.
Oh, it's funny that you mentioned that. I literally saw a tweet about this and someone said it's 2018 and my bank is still down for like 6 hours once a month. And you're not getting 6 hours down a month.
Right. And those are planned outages. What happens when you have an unplanned outage? And again, this is not customer facing downtime. This is what happens when you're down. Something happens and you have to go down. Yes, the customers might be back up in a day, but how long does it take the rest of the team to pull your entirety of your system and your infrastructure and your data back online?
But still, you would say that if we could grab a CTO for like a small credit union and then just drop them on this podcast right now, they would probably, you know, harumph, and they would say, well, you know, it's important to be cautious. It's money we're talking about, blah blah blah, highly regulated, blah blah blah, safety of the customer.
Sure, safety of the customer. How much is it costing you to be down like this? Because also, when you're down, let's think about risk, exposure, security. And if you can only, there are two also related things in here. If it takes you months to get a change through, what happens to your security posture when you need to get a patch through, a compliance mm-hmm. update through, a security patch through, and it takes you months to get through? And then what's the difference between your regular change process and your emergency change process?
One thing I might think about, which actually you touch on a little bit in the report as well, is the idea of manual work versus automated work. A lot of people would argue that those downtimes are a time for manual tasks that require a great deal of attention to detail.
Sure. And we all know that manual work, particularly in times of stress and overwork and burnout, is where we tend to see more mistakes happen by no fault of the people working. Hmm. So then you're only introducing more risk and more error. And by the way, the thing I just mentioned, when we are introducing changes in emergency situations, mm-hmm. the emergency changes that we're trying to introduce into the system as quickly as we can to recover from failure, mm-hmm. the big difference there is we usually skip testing, which is the time that we should not be skipping testing.
Ooh, that's a tough one.
Right? Like
I've been in the data center at the bank when that happened. That's such a, okay, everyone, let's test. You know, ooh, that's tough.
Right. I mean, I've been working on systems that are down at hospitals and we're hours away from evacuating an ICU. And we're desperately trying to institute emergency changes. And right then it's like, we have to get this change and we don't have time for tests. And suddenly we're like, oh my gosh, we don't have time for tests. Mm-hmm. Like, dear God in heaven, please let this change work, right?
A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at Telerik.com/Hanselman. That's Telerik.com/Hanselman. Your elites are doing very little manual testing. They're doing a lot less manual testing than the highs and the mediums. It's a very, an elite performer in the DevOps space is a very automated group.
Or they're doing it very strategically. Uh-huh. They have incredibly efficient mm-hmm. test suites. They have great parallelization so that they can be very, very strategic about exploratory testing, manual testing where it matters, right? Our low performers and especially our medium performers, if you don't have those test suites in place, you're then having to do manual testing, right? You're having to bang on the system everywhere. But if you have these incredible test suites in place that, by the way, have been developed by developers and by testers, because when developers help write tests, we write better and more testable code, right? When we know that it's going to need to be tested, we write more testable code. Mm-hmm. But if we have everyone having to do all of our tests manually, that's just not scalable.
And these are best practices, though. One of the things that I feel like people aren't recognizing is that we are standing on the shoulders of giants for a reason. Like, a lot of these things that people, these characteristics of elite performers, are best practices. And the people who are identifiably, demonstrably medium and low performers are shunning best practices explicitly, and they're paying the price.
Right. And, you know, it's not always their fault, or, you know, they're just scrambling to try to keep up.
Yeah. You have a quote here where you say that teams that adopt essential cloud characteristics are 23 times more likely to be elite performers. What are cloud characteristics and why is it
yes.
so important?
You know, I love this part of the report, so I'm going to give a tiny bit of context. Okay. I So often when we do this research, and I will point this out too, we do point out that to kind of work into this section of the report, we ask questions about where people are. Are they in the cloud? Are they not in the cloud? And we say, you know, the fact that we as an industry are unclear about if we're in the cloud or not can explain why so many reports and vendor reports don't reflect our experience. And so when we're doing research and even internal to our own organizations, when we're doing metrics and monitoring and reporting, it's so important to make sure we have good, solid definitions of what it is that we think we're reporting on and what it is we think we're measuring. And so one thing we did in the report is I included sort of a gotcha question, honestly. We started by asking if people are in the cloud. Just a simple question, right? If the primary service or application that you're working on is in the cloud, how much do you agree with that statement? Okay. And then we moved on to a very solid definition of what cloud computing is. And we pulled that from NIST, right? National Institute of Standards and Technology, because they have a definition of what it actually means to be doing cloud computing. And it pulls down to 5 essential characteristics. And so then we asked people if they do these 5 things for the primary service or application that they work on. And only 22% of people who previously said that they're working in the cloud are actually doing these 5 things. And I think this helps illuminate what's happening when people say, well, you know, we move to the cloud, but we don't see any of the benefits that people say come from the cloud. And we're like, okay, yeah, like you can't just say you're in the cloud and it doesn't work, right? I think Corey Quinn had this hilarious tweet the other day saying, like, you can't just like throw a sticker on your data center and say that you're in the cloud now. So these 5 characteristics of what actually makes cloud computing are this. So the first is on-demand self-service. You can provision resources as needed automatically without human interaction. Okay. You can't put in a ticket. If you use a ticket, fail. Sorry. Love you. Fail. Number 2, broad network access. Capabilities are available through anything: mobile phones, tablets, laptops, workstations, right? Okay. Broad network access. Number 3 is resource pooling. Resources are pooled in like a multi-tenant model. Okay, so physical, virtual resources are dynamically assigned and reassigned on demand. Number 4, rapid elasticity. Mm. So now most people think about this when we think about the cloud, right? So we can think about like bursting and stuff. And then number 5 is measured service. So here is where our cloud systems can kind of automatically control and optimize resource use. And again, this is where kind of the bursting comes, right? Mm-hmm. And the resource usage can be monitored, controlled, and reported for transparency. This one's also really nice, right? Because of the reporting aspect.
The elasticity aspect of things. I love that word in the context of the cloud. The idea that I can, you know, provision and release stuff that scaling isn't a life event like it used to be.
Right. Oh, yeah. I remember those days. I love how you say that's not a life event.
I used to work at a company called 800.com. Like literally it was 800.com. You probably should not go there now because I have no idea what's there. But this was back in the early days of the internet when it was like everything had 3-letter domains, right? Like,
oh yeah.
I worked at 800.com and I worked at gear.com when you could actually like have an idea for a noun and use all the vowels and consonants. You didn't have to like remove a vowel to be creative.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when we went and sold 3 DVDs for $1. That was our big Black Friday sale. And scaling from 3 machines to 6 like involved driving down to PC Micro Center and getting the machines and racking them. Like it was rapid elasticity was scaling in a week and a half, 2-week period. And it was extremely stressful. And it was... But it was the way that we did DevOps 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, and back then, it was much more difficult, right? Like, it was a lot harder. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have, you know, distributed systems set up the way we do now.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to work in data centers. My first job was on a mainframe.
Yeah.
So, I feel this. I was working in labs. I was laying cable.
So the report can be gotten online, and I'm going to make sure that we have a link to that at cloudplatformonline.com, and then there's a link to go directly to that. I'll make a little link, and I'll tweet about it as well. But I also want to point out there's even more depth in the book, Accelerate the Science Behind DevOps. It's like a 200, 300-page book, And you got some praise from people that don't typically praise books. You've got Tom and Mary Poppendick in there. You've got Martin Fowler. Why did this book like land so well? Is it because of the rigor of the science behind it?
I think there's a few things, right? I think the rigor really helps because then it's not just a bunch of like, this is, I think this is a good idea. I think this is kind of an opinion. I know. Yeah. The rigor really convinced Martin. You know, he's been following our work for the last few years. And I will actually say he was sort of a big nudge in writing it. I bumped into him at a conference and he pulled me aside and he said, you've got to write this book. And I'm like, dude, I know, right? I'm busy. And he goes, no, if you don't write it, I will. I was like, whoa, what? So he was kidding.
I love that Martin finally bumped into you and he's like, you need to write this. And you're like, dude, I know. That's how I talked to Martin Fowler as well. Sure, don't we all?
He was so funny. Well, and then I told him later that, you know, his threat to write the book, and if I didn't, he would. He goes, I was kidding. And I was like, well, it's probably good I didn't know you were kidding because that's what kicked my butt into gear.
the gaze of Sauron is turned in our direction. We better get this book out before Fowler writes it for us.
Exactly. So, and it's interesting because that also made sure that I had a really, really solid section in the back. So the interesting thing is some people love the whole book. Mm-hmm. Some people really love part. So we have three parts. Part one is everything that we have found. It's the findings, the results.
Right. What we found, the research and transformation.
Yep. The research and transformation. Part two is the science behind it. Mm-hmm. My nerd moment came when my PhD advisor texted me and she said, this is like a beautiful take on, kind of an elegant take on survey measures and how to do them and how to lay it out the right way, but also how it relates to a few other people have actually DM'd me, which I think I'm a little proud of too, how to relate it to system measures. So if you're in an organization and you want to capture measures out of systems, because that's actually what I started from, doing like systems and log analysis and how to think about measures this way, how to relate them and how to measure things and how to think about them and put data together and analyze it in a good holistic way. Mm-hmm. Some people really love that because like they've read the reports or they're like, I already know what I'm doing, but I need to think about measurement in an organization and communicating measurement. Mm-hmm. And then part three is a case study from ING. So how to put all of this into practice. And that was actually contributed by Steve Bell and Karen Whitley Bell. They were very, very lovely and gracious. They were early readers to the book. And they said, you know, it might help people to be able to visualize what this looks like in practice. And I said, you know, I think I am best served writing about the science. Mm-hmm. And I've helped organizations through this. And we were on a phone call and they said, we'd be willing to write it for you. And I was like, oh my gosh, what? Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was fantastic. So it was nice that it kind of came together in those three parts.
That's great.
And some people love that part the best because they can see it and feel it. And the way that Steve and Karen have written it is really like a day in the life. It's walking through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to point out also, just as we close the podcast here, that you would think that books with this much work behind it, with this much science, would be very expensive and you'd be spending $50-$60 on it. But you can go up on Amazon right now and the Kindle version of this book is very modestly priced. You can get it in paperback. And I think it's just a fantastic resource. This is not a pamphlet. This is 300 pages of really, really thoughtful research by some experienced folks in the space. And I really appreciate you coming on the show with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great to chat.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.